Oh, I'm sorry. Did I break your concentration?
Somewhere between science and superstition.
We have such sights to show you.
Strange Eons.
Welcome to Strange Eons Radio. That's Eric over there.
Hello.
That's Vanessa over there.
Hello.
Hey, guys. Last time we're recording at the house.
Crazy.
Everything gone but the table, basically. And you guys are helping me move that over to the new place after the show. So.
Yep. This is it.
This is it.
Goodbye, roof.
Matt.
Goodbye, Siegel.
Oh, roof. I say, well, we probably still have a ceiling.
Goodbye, crazy homeless people down the street.
Oh. I will not miss you.
Seagulls, yes.
Racist restaurants underneath our feet. This could be a storybook, sure. Easily.
Yes, yeah. A lot to tell.
As you might have guessed, not a lot of time for me to be watching stuff right now. But I managed to get in a couple of things that I don't think either of you are watching about.
Ooh.
And I will start with season 2 of Evil.
Oh, hey, cool. I saw season 1.
Yes, and you can only see season 2 if you've got Paramount Plus.
Yeah, it's now in a Paramount Plus original.
Yes.
Star Trek.
Well, funnily enough, I have Paramount Plus because I had CBS All Access.
Right.
And then one day I was like, why do I have Paramount Plus? What the fuck is this? I guess they're the same.
It's for all that Star Trek stuff.
It's the only reason I have it.
Well, you should watch season 2, episode 4 now, and they're releasing it weekly and all that. The reason I got into this show, of course, because it has Mike Coulter, who is that very attractive bald black man from Luke Cage.
He is so hot. I was wondering where I knew him from.
He's ridiculously attractive. And playing a wannabe priest. I'm not sure that this all tracks in the way I think the world works, and how attractive you are kind of depends on what you do for a living.
I think there, having gone to Catholic school for 8 years, I cannot think of any attractive priests. So I think you're right. There's something to do it.
I have one exception. When I stayed at the Seattle University dorms for a couple of years, they had priests on every... because it's a Catholic or Christian university or something.
Yeah, theology school.
And we had Indiana Jones was our priest.
Oh, man.
He kind of dressed like him, looked like him. He was pretty damn cool. Unfortunately, you know, I have nothing to do with him.
I bet he's no longer a priest,
He didn't
though.
Diddle you or anything?
No.
Oh, my God.
Are you sure he was a priest?
He couldn't have been a priest. If he wasn't drunk or molesting children, then it's not possible.
I can't answer properly on A. But I don't know anything about...
Edit all this out. We're losing listeners.
If you can't take the truth.
Evil, very good. Also stars Michael Emerson, who is one of my other favorite actors. And because it's on Paramount Plus, it seems like it's a little gorier and a little... The language is a little stronger.
Yeah, I felt like the first season, there were some genuinely creepy moments, but there was like a lot of like... mildness to it.
Yeah. Huh. Not this season. I'm really loving this.
That's awesome.
You'd mentioned it someplace. And I was like, oh, completely forgot about that. So I jumped back in. I think I was on like episode 4, which I missed a segment or something, but they're wearing, during an exorcism, they're all wearing sunglasses.
Oh, I think I remember
which
that.
Which makes for a fairly humorous episode. Yeah. It's fun. It's pretty cool. They're all still really good. It's like, this is weird to jump back into, but yeah, it's still good.
I think episode 4 is about when that series starts taking off.
Yeah.
So
it felt very different than the first ones.
Hmm. Well, I watched I've been watching a show that's kind of got the opposite issue. The Good Place.
Oh.
So I'm on season 3. I think I'm almost done with season 3. And this was a show that I tried to watch before and thought was not very good. And I usually hate sitcoms, but by season 3 at the start, I was like really into it and really excited. It took a while of ramping up because the sitcom tropes were frustrating to me. Mm-hmm. But once they got past that, like every single day is the same thing, mm-hmm. I was really stoked about it. The only downside being, of course, that they do a lot of talk about hell, not a lot of show in hell. They're like constantly going on about like inserting bees into people's veins and poking out eyeballs. They'll say it, but then you see nothing because obviously they don't have a budget for it.
Well, also that would really ruin the tone of the movie.
It would ruin the tone of the show. Yeah. But it is funny because there was a while there where I was like, are they going to like show any of this? No? Okay.
Not really. I don't think they ever really do. I mean, they go to hell a little bit.
Yeah.
But it's more like boardroom stuff, which is pretty funny.
Yeah, it is. It's clearly they're using a lot of sets. Like all the time, every episode, I'm like, oh, this is the set you end up in. Okay, cool. You went to a bar. It looks awfully similar to the other bar you went to, but with new stuff on the walls. But yeah, I am happy that it has constantly shaken up its own formula, and that's been extremely interesting to me.
So. That's really good. I like that one a
and
lot.
And Ted Danson.
Hey, who is fantastic.
So good. I remember having a crush on him when I was a kid because he was in Cheers.
Cheers.
Sam.
Yeah.
Oh, that's
has
a
not
good
lost
one.
It.
I watched another doc about filmmakers. One that I'm going, I pretty much guess I learned most of what I can about this guy. Val Lewton.
Oh,
okay. Oh my gosh.
The Man in the Shadows. So I'm watching this going, okay, yeah, I've heard about this.
Yeah. What did you watch this on?
It's a extra on the Cat People Criterion.
Oh, okay.
That's cool.
But it was a produced film in like 2008. So I don't know what it was produced for. It was A&E or something. But I mean, it's good. It covers him well. It's nice because it's, you know, visual. I did not realize, and maybe he said this on the podcast, but I did not realize there's no like home movies of him. There's no recorded audio of his voice. He was so kind of underground and not interested in being the center of attention that he really wasn't. Man, dude was so good. The stuff he came up with was so good. And he got so
screwed. You're talking
screwed.
About the podcast or you're talking, no, talking about Val Lewton.
Okay. He got so screwed over for being talented and nobody recognizing it. And I think one of my favorite little tidbits about him is Boris Karloff wanting to work with him and him having no interest in wanting to work with Boris Karloff because he hated the Universal movies so much. And then when they get together, they find out they have very similar sensibilities. And they went on to make some really, really good films, like Bedlam, which is one of my favorites they did. Aww. The dude, if you haven't seen any Val Lewton, man, go see it. If you haven't seen Curse of the Cat People, I definitely recommend that one. His standard stuff is really good, but that one is so weird.
Yeah.
And so out of left field. And one of the biggest problems I think he had was he kept getting saddled with titles. And he'd have to make the movie based on the title, which he really necessarily didn't, except for maybe Cat People.
Right.
But Leopard Man was sort of that way. I Walked with a Zombie. I guess technically somebody walked with a zombie, but boy, that movie's so much better than that title. It was fun to watch and, you know, like, okay, cool. I guess I learned most of what I need to.
I do have one question for you, though. Have you ever heard of the podcast You Must Remember This?
Yeah, I've never listened to it, but I've heard of it.
Okay, yeah. They actually have some really interesting deep dives, historical deep dives of different early Hollywood people, and they definitely did a Boris Karloff series and talked about Val Lewton as well. So maybe there's still some nugget in there for you out there past
I would
Criterion.
Say probably not after the secret life
secret
of Hollywood.
Secret history of Hollywood.
Yeah.
Wow. He did what, 15 to 20 plus hours
Whoa.
About Val Lewton?
Of just Whoa. About Val Lewton.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, never mind then.
And he does it as almost like radio dramas. He's incredibly good voice and incredibly good writer.
Yeah.
And his stuff is just deeply fascinating.
Wow. Yeah. I've not heard of this.
Search that one out. The narrator, the podcaster is Adam Roach.
Yeah.
And just everything. He's done him on Hitchcock and on
Clark Gable. Not Clark Gable. Guy in Arsenic and Old Lace and North by Northwest. And Cary Grant.
Cary Grant, thank you.
I think he's in the middle of that one. I don't know if he's done with that. It's hard to tell sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah, because he'll just drop an episode and it'll be like 2.5 hours long. Like, okay. Next chapter is up.
Yep. Who has time? Who has time to do this?
I listened to those Valute, and I could not wait for everyone to show up. And there were episodes where I was crying at the end.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, my God.
They're brilliant. They're some of the best stuff I've ever listened to in podcasting. They're just...
Damn, guys.
Amazing.
Well, you're on our show now, listeners. So.
You're probably never going to cry listening to us.
I don't know.
You might cry because the next thing I saw is pretty fucking amazing. Okay. The Bad Batch on Disney Plus.
I have not seen it.
I've seen the first four episodes, I think.
It gets better.
Does it? Okay.
I was ready to jettison this show, which is a continuation of the Clone Wars cartoon.
Right.
And there's something that's a little more aimed towards kids than adults in this, but it's finally kind of like all of those animated shows like Rebels and the Clone Wars and all that. They start out one way, and then as they start building their mythology, it gets more and more interesting. And I think that adults require that to watch something. And I think that they start out easy for the kids who are obviously watching it. And then they can build that, and the kids don't have to just jump into something that might be a little too complicated at the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you started with the Star Wars prequels as your first Star Wars, you might need a little spoon-feeding storylines before it gets too deep.
Sure, yeah. So I would say that this is getting pretty interesting. What's really interesting is it's a group of the clone troopers who are... something went wrong with their chip, so Order 66 didn't stick with them. But because it's a group of these five or six clones, they're all voiced by the same voice actor, and he's got to just kind of change his voice a little bit for each one. Oh, it's like, God. Oh, my God. Yeah. For a while there, it was saying something like, they were listing off the names of the clone troopers and then his name after it. Now it just says in the credits, the Bad Batch, this guy. So, yeah, I'm starting to enjoy it.
Good.
That's awesome. Well, I finally, I'm late to the party, but I finally got around to watching Nobody on something I paid some money for, I'm sure. Amazon, I think. And, yeah, that was a really fun, uplifting, emotionally satisfying movie.
I take it this really is not the it. Nobody I talked about.
This is the new Nobody.
The new Nobody.
Okay.
Like, I don't know. Is there another movie named Nobody?
You don't pay attention to what you talk about.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
This is the one that's John Wick starring Saul from Better Call Saul.
I just was watching a bunch of people badmouth this movie on something, and they were all people I knew because it was on a social thing. And I was like, you know what? You guys would be zero fun to sit next to at a party.
That's the problem. People, it's so easy to crap on a movie.
One of the assholes was like, I can't even imagine trying to sit through this.
What?
I'm like, okay, fuck off then.
Dude, you have not watched any Disney Clubhouse.
What I wish would be like a rule for people who make comments on films. When they say, this movie sucks, at the very least... I want a reason why.
Yeah.
And if you can't provide me a reason why, you need to list what you think are great fucking movies. So I know if your taste is worth anything. Because there was some guy, there's a list on Letterboxd, which is this unbelievably comprehensive list of damn near every horror film, period. Mm. It's like 13,000 films or something. And this dipshit posts on it, well, such and such movie isn't horror. So I'm like, okay, let's see what this asshole likes. So I pop onto his Letterboxd. And all of I could not find a single horror movie in his entire ratings of films he's watched. I'm like,
God.
Your opinion means absolutely jack shit. Yeah. You are not worth listening to.
Everybody should kind of take a step back and realize your opinion means jack shit.
Yes.
And you know, I mean, our opinions mean jack shit, right? Except for mine. So.
Sure.
Yours is just shit. Is that what you're saying?
I love what Eric's saying, though. We should have like the scarlet letter. Like, we should either be tattooed or forced to wear like pins of like our top like five films. And then people will automatically be able to know whether or not we have trustworthy opinions.
Oh, I like this idea.
I'm so in.
We're going to initiate this at all the Strange Eons radio gatherings.
Oh, nice.
Well, I just find it so frustrating. I know we've talked about it before. But it's so easy to be like, oh, you know what? I'm smart and this movie sucks because you can tell I'm cool and interesting because I'm going to shit on this thing. And yeah, that's how you know I'm good. It's like, you know what? It's hard to find good things about every film, but it's so much more interesting to look for them. You are a better human being if you spend time going, okay, what is it I like about this? What's working about this? Mm. And okay, why isn't it working? Rather than just being like, you know what? If I say the soundtrack is pedestrian, I'm going to be so fucking cool at the party.
Vanessa, I couldn't tell you what I didn't like about the movie. I didn't see it. It just looked stupid.
Well, then I just refuse to talk to those human beings because they don't deserve breath.
Boy, especially with nobody, because that is not what it's advertised as. If you just watch the trailer for that movie, you have no idea what you're going to watch.
Oh my God. Yeah.
I'm glad you liked it.
Yeah, it was super fun. I had a great time.
It was like John Wick with a sense of humor.
Yes, yes, definitely. It was a funnier John Wick. And I did just the opening scene when he gets to the point where he's pulling all these things out of his coat and he pulls out a kitten and he sets it down and then he pulls out a can of tuna and opens it and the cat eats the tuna. It's so good. You're like, what is happening right now? It's a very good setup.
That opening scene was the pitch that the writer gave Bob Odenkirk when he said, you know, I want to get into something like this. And so he basically walked him through that whole scene and then said, you know, who are you? Who am I? And then the credit splashes on there. Bob Odenkirk goes, I want to make this movie.
Oh my God. So good.
Nice. That's awesome. Massacre Mafia style.
Oh boy. Geez, you're just going to throw that at us?
Directed by Duke Mitchell.
Duke Mitchell. What a name.
Director of maybe a little bit more known film of his called Gone with the Pope.
Nope, I don't know that one either.
John Skip was talking about this one a few years ago, and it is, Gone with the Pope he was. That one is a guy in the movie, they kidnap the Pope and say they'll release him when every Catholic in the world sends them a dollar.
Oh my God. It's a lot of money.
Massacre Mafia style isn't quite that deep in its plot line. Duke Mitchell's a 70s Italian guy who was really annoyed with the way 70s Italian movies were being made and the way Italians were being portrayed. So he went ahead and made these Italian mafia movies. Massacre Mafia style starts off with what was actually the trailer. It's like 3 minutes of these guys busting into various rooms and killing everybody in the rooms. And then walking through the halls of what looks like a weird hotel and killing everybody they run into. So the movie is this ridiculous. It's one of those films where you hear somebody complain about this movie doesn't realistically portray the reality, but I'm going to do this cartoonishly way over the top ridiculous version and pretend like this is the way the mafia really acts. And it is so over but it's funny and it's heartfelt and it's on Arrow.
I knew it.
And it's all making sense now.
There you go. It is, he's got these long scenes sitting at a table talking about the importance of his mom and all this stuff. We then later like killed or through his actions, she gets killed because of something he does. I'm like, you don't really follow your words too well, do you? It is just another one of those cool films made by somebody with all balls, very little talent, but just went for it and made a very watchable. I would go, you know, if you really want to dive in deep into Duke Mitchell, he's got these two films and that's all he made. So I would just go with the one of Gone with the Pope, which is much better. Because it's so ridiculous. But yeah, 70 Mafia movie done in a very unique way.
So this was made in the 70s?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, very much.
God damn it. I'm going to have to get this Arrow service. I keep saying that, but I keep forgetting.
Well, you know, you're busy right now.
I've had things on my mind, you guys.
Yeah, yep. Give it time.
Should we take a little break?
Sure.
Yeah.
And then we're coming back. We're talking martial arts.
Son, true strength comes from heart. He's gonna do it.
This
discover the secrets of karate with Karate Kid dry action figures.
Concentrate, Daniel, son.
They chop, twist, and kick. Karate Kid dry action figures are each sold separately. And for more action, look for the Karate Kid Competition Center from Remco.
We have returned, and Eric, we are talking about your topic choice.
That's right. Well, I did the self-indulgent thing we do sometimes, like, damn it, I want to watch this movie. It's been in the back of my head as one that I've never watched, that at least for a while was talked about a lot. I don't know if it still is as much, but as it's known now, The Last Dragon, or as it was released originally, Berry Gordy's The Last Dragon.
A martial arts champion in search of the glow.
Master, I need more time.
I am no longer your master.
A rock and roll star on the rise.
I know what it's like to lose precious things.
A madman.
Shogun of Harlem.
A maniac.
You're going to put my video on your show, aren't you?
The answer is no.
And the glamour. The power and the sound of Motown.
I don't want you to kill anybody.
Are you out of your mind?
The Leroy Green I'm looking for is a little punk thinks he's a kung fu master.
I am no master.
You sure look like a master to me.
This is Berry Gordy's The Last Dragon.
To the beat of the rhythm of the night.
It's about the power of the glow. Timok, Vanity. Berry Gordy's The Last Dragon, directed by Michael Schultz, a Motown Productions picture from TriStar.
Oh, that's a mouthful.
Man, I can't wait to hear what you think of this because I unapologetically love this movie.
No problem, man. This is one that's available from many sources. I actually picked up the Blu-ray for $10 during on Amazon.
Nice.
Screw it. I'll take that. The Rotten Tomatoes critics, 58. Crowd, 86.
There you go.
Budget of $10 million. The box office is either $25 or $33 million, depending on where you look.
Okay.
So it did well. It did very well. It was not received very well, but it made a lot of money. Directed by Michael Schultz, who has 113 directing credits. He's still working today on All-American and recently Black Lightning, Blackish, Arrow. He started earlier in his career with Car Wash and Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
Boy.
And Crush Groove, which, you know, right in line sort of tonally with The Last Dragon. Written by Louis Venosita, who wrote Bird on a Wire and Kisses in the Dark. Producer. I list the producer in this one, which we don't normally do, because somehow, some way, and I really couldn't fully figure out any other reason other than he put up the money and coordinated music mainly, was Berry Gordy, who has a very impressive resume, though. He's involved in The Wiz, Lady Sings the Blue, Hitsville, The Making of Motown, 360 soundtrack credits, many as songwriter.
Wow.
So he's deeply involved in that.
Creator of the Motown sound, yeah.
Yeah. Hmm. So yeah, he had the movie money to obviously finance this movie very easily. Stars Timok, I guess how the guy says his name?
Timok.
It is Timok, okay. His first film, but he's been in Book of Swords, Beverly Hills 90210, Fight the Panda Syndicate.
What?
I don't know.
The whole syndicate of them.
And one of Prince's proteges, Vanity, is the lead in this one as well. She's Action Jackson. She was in Vanity 6 with Prince put together. Friday the 13th TV series. Silk Stockings. A couple episodes of Highlander TV show. She passed away quite a few years ago now, I believe. Christopher Murney, who was in Slapshot, Maximum Overdrive, Barton Fink, and Red Dead Redemption.
Yeah.
A great video game. Julius Carey playing the role of Shonuff. Yes. He's well known from The Fish That Saved Pittsburgh. Lots of TV, Tales from the Crypt, and 27 episodes of The Adventures of Buckaroo, of Adventures of Briscoe County Jr.
Yes. Huh.
I've got a lot, I'm listening to a lot of people here because Mike, it just kind of floored me. I've got Mike Starr, who you may not recognize the name, but I guarantee you'd recognize him. 240 credits. He's got 4 movies in pre-production and 4 movies in post-production right now. You might best know him from Dumb and Dumber. He's the guy who takes the too many hot peppers and dies in the restaurant while they're traveling across the country. Uncle Buck, Miller's Crossing. William H. Macy and Chaz Palminteri both have a scene or two in this movie.
Wow.
Weird.
It's just like, good Lord. I stopped after that. It's like, fuck, man. Hey, it's the good old TriStar Picture logo. Da-da-da. I remember that one. So the movie begins, because it is the 80s, with a training montage. So, you know. And they introduce you to the concept of the glow and the power you will find when you reach something. And the teacher gives him a little glow thing from apparently from Bruce Lee. Some aspects of this movie do not age well. The outfit he leaves the place in is the it looks straight out of a Shaw Brothers movie, maybe, or something like that, where it's
traditional kung fu.
Yeah. But they do include footage from one of the greatest martial arts movies ever made, Enter the Dragon, complete with breakdancing in the aisles during the showing of the movie. And here is the introduction to the character that really brings the whole movie together, Shona. Mm-hmm. I've gone, this movie seems all right. And then they introduce Shona. And it starts off with people, I don't remember the exact lines, but they're saying like, who's the greatest fighter in the area?
Shona.
And it's just like 5 or 6, and it's so perfect. I'm going, okay, I'm in. I'm going to like this one. So he comes in, and being, again, an 80s martial arts movies where they're pulling from the 70s movies, he's got to be the best fighter there. And he's heard the legend of Bruce Lee Roy, who is supposed to be the best fighter. Who's very unaware of what's going on in the world, just sitting there watching the movie, eating his popcorn. The first fight, though, is not a great fight. The fight choreography in this movie is not the greatest. It seems like it's far enough along in this world where it might have been a little better, but it's still fun, so it doesn't matter.
This movie is best viewed as a long-form video instead of a kung fu movie.
Yes, it is a music video. And not only is it a music video, it's DeBarge.
Feel the beat of the rhythm of the night, dancing to the morning light, forget about your troubles all the time, we can leave it all behind.
Did they pay to have him come and perform at Vanity's Club for real? No, they just show the music video as being part of the screens in the video.
Oh my God.
Wow. And they show a good chunk of the music. There's a lot of that video in there. The fashion is movies 80s fashion, which wasn't really how most people actually dressed, sure, but how people overdressed. Oh man, the first performance by Vanity. Whew, she should have stayed with Prince, man. It is so bad. And it was nominated for a Razzie.
Oh boy.
As worst song. It is terrible.
That's so unfortunate.
It's a little weird too, in that the movie setup, she's performing kind of in a club sort of setting, but the club looks like the crowd that would be at a Captain Kangaroo show screening or something. They're very young looking. Oh. A lot of the crowd is.
Could it just be that you are an old man and everybody looks young?
No, these are like under teens.
Oh, okay.
Like tweens and stuff. You know, the young brother who gets the crush on Vanity.
Yes.
Yeah. It's that about that crowd age is a large portion of the crowd. So it's like, all right. The basic plot line is some gangster guy wants her to play his protege's music video at the club, and she refuses to. And that's really the catalyst of the entire storyline.
Yes.
Back when music videos were king.
That's right. And she refused to, and they try to kidnap her, and of course, Bruce Leroy is there to rescue her. but he loses his token. Oh, it's so sad. Anyways, but the movie goes on. He seems to be wearing a variety of Bruce Lee costumes. Was that first one sort of reminiscent to some of the Bruce Lee probably wore in a movie? The all yellow with the black stripe is definitely something Bruce Lee wore in a movie.
Yeah.
Let's see. And then it continues on with the my martial arts class is better than your martial arts class. Of course, he refuses to fight. Guess, you know, it's not, his life isn't in danger. There's nothing serious going on. So he will not fight. And he refuses the call for a long time in this movie. A lot of shit goes bad. Like a whole bunch of his students get their ass kicked in this scene. He doesn't do anything. There's bad aspects to this movie that are great. And one of them is his attempt to try to see the master by bringing in a pizza. an all sprouts pizza.
So it would have been a good episode for the pizza.
Yeah.
That would have been perfect.
Because his parents own a pizza stand, which, of course, shows up to mm-hmm. and subsequently trashes the hell out of with a really, really nice clean break of a of a table. still doesn't fight back. He just gets angry and goes on a punching bag for a while. The bad lady song that the villain guy has sort of sounds like somebody was annoyed with Cyndi Lauper. Mm. And it's like, we're going to make her kind of sound like Cyndi Lauper. But it's a better song than the first one Vanity sang.
Oh, no.
Jesus.
And then now we get more Bruce Lee, which is always nice. I forgot which movie it is. You see more Bruce Lee fighting. So, you know, the fighting escalates there. His little brother is kind of annoying at times, but, you know, what are you going to do? Leroy is painfully naive through a large portion of this film.
Absolutely.
His ability to flirt and then not know how to react to her flirting back to him is like, ouch, dude. At times, it becomes hard to tell if they're doing parody or straightforward, but that's okay. The biggest problem with the movie, unfortunately, is show enough kind of disappears. For a large chunk of it.
Mm.
He seems to be, they sort of have two villains. Sure enough is a great fun villain. The other guy whose name I can't remember is kind of an annoying mobster villain.
Yeah.
And they move to his story for the latter part of the second act. I'm like, well, bring back Sure enough. He makes this movie so much better. So they all show up for a big battle. Very Mortal Kombat looking. Whole bunch of the people look like the people who made Mortal Kombat watch this movie and go, let's make a guy who looks like him and a guy who looks like him.
Very possible.
And they do a martial arts fight, I guess you could say, which is fun, actually. This scene is a lot of fun. The one guy who can't fight suddenly can fight mm-hmm. very well. And, of course, the little kid does horrible violence to the level of no kid could ever possibly do against a grown man. But it's funny. And it's not the same little kid. It's not his little brother. It's like a kid that was in the class.
I think that little kid is the kid who grew up to be one of the Ninja Turtles, if I'm remembering right. I think his name is Ernie Chan.
That sounds right, cool. He went on to quite a career.
Yeah.
Done a lot. Probably the most successful actor, at least, to come out of the film.
Yeah, and a legit kung fu legend.
Yeah. I would kind of say the movie needed another pass in editing. Shorten it up a little bit, bring Show Enough back. But it's got a fun ending. Group at the dance club still is not very good dancers. The freeze frame end credits are just epic. So, yes, I enjoyed this movie. I'm glad I watched it. I am fine that I now own it. It's let's see, some notes on it. Vanity was only cast in it because her relationship with Prince fell apart. She was supposed to be the lead in Purple Rain.
Oh.
But they were not getting along anymore. So she was removed from that. She did die very young, about 57, having become evangelical and denounced her younger years, music and lifestyle of dating, like, was it Nikki Sixx? Well, probably Prince. She had some drug issues and stuff in the 80s, but she seemed to get better and have a nicer life, hopefully, there at the end. Some people considered for the role, and I'm always a little antsy on considered for, because that could be, you know, you and me sitting down, hey, you know who would be good in this movie?
Right.
But Billy Blanks.
Oh, my God. Yes.
Wesley Snipes. Mario Van Peebles, Denzel Washington, and apparently Lawrence Fishburne tried very hard to get cast as Shona.
Oh my God.
Which probably would have been just fine. Yeah. I think he would have been good at that.
He'd be so young though.
Well, he was what, 17 or something, Apocalypse Now, so he'd probably been in his 20s by then.
I guess so.
But yeah, he'd be pretty young. This was the lead actor was 19-year-old Black Belt, so they hired him as a martial artist and then taught him acting on the set, which not the greatest choice.
It's pretty obvious.
Yeah, he has fine moments and he's got terrible moments, mm-hmm. but he's got a good screen presence. I think with more training, he could have been pretty good. But what you going to do? Well, Show Enough was the opposite. He is an actor who learned martial arts on the set, and boy, is that obvious, too. You can't kick. One of the key things, again, being mid-80s, you're looking at the hit songs. What can we get hit songs from the movie? Music was supervised by Gordy. Had the DeBarge song, Rhythm of the Night, written by Diane Warner, hit number 3 on Billboard, number 1 on the R&B charts. Richard Perry produced title theme, was nominated for Worst Original Song at the Raspberries, and Vanity's song Seventh Heaven was also nominated for Worst Song at the Raspberries.
Jeez.
And so it went
award-winning film, The Last Dragon.
There you go.
That's how the
press mm-hmm. release goes out.
That's right. It did also get nominated for Golden Globes for Rhythm of the Night.
Nice.
Oh, sure.
I was considered an original song for the movie, even though it's not really part of the song. Anyways, so yeah, Last Dragon and Seventh Heaven were 1986 Worst Original Song nominees. And there's a beginning where Leroy Green karate chops an arrow as it moves through the air. That was real.
Oh.
He actually did that. It took 2 hours for them to get it on camera, but he did martial art crack an arrow in two.
Whoa.
I like that you called it martial art crack.
Yeah.
He martial art cracked it.
That's right.
Darn right he did.
Karate chopped it.
I have a Berry Gordy story, if you don't mind me telling you.
No, please.
Eric, you were actually part of this story, but you weren't there. You and I had gone to some Seattle film meeting with all of these people there. Sure. I just remember that Schneider from One Day at a Time was the big name there. Mm. Although, no, that's not true, because Harvey Korman was also there.
Yeah.
And so we're just kind of milling about. And I was feeling very uncomfortable, very young. God, what was I, 24 or something?
Probably.
And one of the guys that we've been working with in some film stuff, he brings this gentleman over and he's like, Kelly, I want you to meet Berry Gordy. And I'm just falling all over myself. And, our buddy says, we're going outside to smoke cigars. You want to join us? And I was just like, I have no idea how to smoke a cigar. I don't want to get sick in front of Berry Gordy. And so I politely turned them down.
Oh, no.
Then I spend the next year of my life learning everything about cigars.
Oh, my
learning
God.
Learning how to cut them, smoke them, do everything. Because I never want this kind of situation.
Right.
Then I run into our buddy again. And I was like, hey, you want to go have a cigar? And he's like, yeah. And I didn't know you like cigars. I love cigars. And here's why. Every time you, or ever since you introduced me to Berry Gordy and I had to turn you down, I learned everything about him. And he said, oh, funny story. We got out there and started smoking. And he goes, you keep introducing me as Berry Gordy. My name is Berry Gordon.
Wow.
So, I became a cigar aficionado because of Berry Gordon.
Berry Gordon.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
What's the difference?
Slight difference.
Wow. That's a good story. Okay. Well, I guess I'll jump in with my picture, which, by the way, Last Dragon, I saw at SIFF Cinema in Uptown. Did a special screening and they gave you a fortune cookie and some chopsticks and everything for. I'd never seen it before. And I remember it being quite magical. So I've got to hunt this back down again.
Yeah.
However, the movie I chose for this fine topic It was something else entirely. And that is the 2000 film Versus. I believe you both have seen this.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. So, Rotten Tomatoes score of 75% critics, 77% audience. So, relatively high.
Yeah.
Budget of about $10,000.
Yeah.
Box office of God knows. Unavailable information. A lot of the cast and crew for this, it's all Japanese. So, a lot of these people, and it's an independent Japanese movie. So, figuring out kind of who's who is not great. However, the director, Ryu Kitamura, he's done 26 things. His first picture was Heat After Dark in 1996. He also, after this film came out, did Godzilla Final Wars in 2004 and Midnight Meat Train in 2008. He also did a segment for Nightmare Cinema in 2018. However, some people will know him from in 2003, he directed the in-game cutscenes for Metal Gear Solid Twin Snakes, a remake for the iconic Metal Gear Solid Nintendo GameCube series. Kitamaru's direction of the cutscenes was viewed as controversial. Criticism leveled at its Matrix-like action tone and unrealistic stunts performed by the characters. Regardless, it went on to receive positive reviews from game review sites. So, good job, sir. And you guys probably both know Midnight Meat Train was based on Clive Barker's short story, the same name. Starred some pretty big names like Bradley Cooper, Vinnie Jones, Brooke Shields, distributed by Lionsgate. So, I have not seen that movie. Is it good?
I think it's really good.
Yeah, it's really solid.
Awesome. Very cool. The writer for this, it's a mix of Kitamaru and also a guy named Yude Yamaguchi. Lots of Japanese TV, also worked on a segment for ABCs of Death, and a few movies that just sounded interesting. I was just picking out of the ether because I don't know what's what over here. So Yakuza Weapon and Meatball Machine. Both sound.
Seen that one.
I've seen Meatball Machine also.
Is it good?
I don't know if it's good, but it falls into that super gory Japanese over-the-top stuff.
It does its genre style well.
Yes.
Yes, and I feel like this film is part of a world, part of a moment in Japanese filmmaking. It stars Tak Sakugachi as prisoner KSC-2303. He's been in 48 things. None of them made any sense to me. The other two people that are kind of the main stars, Hideo Sakaki plays the man, and Chieko Misaka plays the girl. The titles of these people are fucking amazing for the cast. It's all things like Yakuza with sunglasses. And like, it's funny because it matched up with the notes I was making where I was like, green shirt, sunglasses, sweater vest. I was like, oh, okay, cool. We're on the same page here. Wonderful.
Was this a first viewing for you?
First viewing.
Oh, okay.
Yes. Never seen it before. Kind of was a recommendation. And I just thought, leap in. Why not? So the plot of this film, this is just kind of the line that's on IMDb. There are 666 portals that connect this world to the other side. These are concealed from all human beings. Somewhere in Japan exists the 444th portal, the Forest of Resurrection. So we start off in ancient Japan, and we see a guy who's clearly the good guy arriving in the forest to fight and confront some other guy who kind of represents the ultimate in evil. They have a fight, and the good guy loses badly and is basically cut in half vertically or horizontally. Horizontally. It's cut horizontally. You get to see a nice little slip, like, oh no, I'm dead. There goes my body moment, which is always enjoyable. So then we cut to present day, where we have two prisoners running through the woods. One has a handcuff still strapped to his hand with a severed hand sticking out of it. As they're running, he kind of pulls it out and throws it on the ground. So it's like, he used to be tied to somebody. Not sure what happened there. So they're making their way through the woods. They arrive at a road where they meet a group of Yakuza who are waiting to help them escape. The Yakuza have with them a girl who's wearing this kind of white sweater, looks a little angelic, in the car. And immediately the girl seems to make this strange connection with one of the two prisoners, although neither really says why or necessarily recognizes what this connection is. So, desperate to leave, the prisoners try to beg the Yakuza to take off, but the Yakuza group basically say, we're waiting for our dude, and we're not going to leave until he's here, the head of this particular little group of Yakuza dudes. So they're like, no, we're not going. And of course, a fight breaks out, and one of the Yakuza of the group dies. However, he instantly pops back up. Death is not death, it seems. In fact, not only does he pop back up, many, many bodies pop back up, because this is a forest where the Yakuza have been burying bodies for years. And not only do they all pop up in this kind of outrageous fight scene that never really ends, they pop up with, like, their weapons fully loaded and ready to go. So you end up with these sort of scenes of the characters running through the woods where, like, a dude will just pop up with, like, an Uzi and start shooting at them. And you're like, what is happening? This is crazy. So kind of a different take on the zombie. I'm not sure they're as into eating people. I didn't see a lot of eating happening. Much more just brutal slaughter. As this all starts to unravel, the prisoner, not really sure why he has a connection to this girl, grabs her hand and runs off into the woods, trying to escape these guys who now want to kill them. And of course, this group of Yakuza follow suit. Eventually, even more Yakuza follow suit, as well as some bounty hunters and the Yakuza boss, who maybe is more than he appears. Hunting of the prisoner and the woman in white is all anyone cares about, and they do so in a very exciting style of lots of crazy fighting, crazy gun, crazy blood, gore, whatever, all over everybody through the whole thing. This movie is bonkers. It's fucking bonkers. I wish I could say, like, I don't even think there's more I can properly explain other than there is more to this tale than meets the eye. Perhaps destiny has a role. It's so fucking crazy. It's like, so I don't know if anyone out there has ever played the Yakuza games, that they're now on like number eight or nine, but they're like these over the top melodramatic games where you have these gangsters who are like big hair, bad suits, like screaming at each other about nonsense, and like crazy shit happens. Like, you can get this like chicken who becomes a supernatural chicken in one of the games to like come and do special power moves and join your crew. Like, it's a fucking bonkers game. This movie reminds me of that. It is like a one-to-one, but add in like super 90s crack, crazy music, crazy camera moves, and zombies, and some Japanese folklore. This movie also is a huge nod to Sam Raimi. There's a lot of stuff stolen from Evil Dead, but also Quick and the Dead. That shot in Quick and the Dead where he shoots through somebody and the camera pulls back through them, that is like five times in this movie. We definitely see through the interior body cavity of many, many people. It's really fun. It's really tongue-in-cheek. There is one actor who did not seem to have any other real credits, who is the Yakuza in the lime green shirt. He is having the time of his goddamn life. He's playing a villain, and he just goes all in. He's just like laughing and jumping and singing and all kinds of stuff. So anyways, trivia for this, because really I can't get any more into the story. Originally, Versus was intended to be a sequel to the director's amateur short film, Down to Hell, with the intention of also shooting Versus on video with a low budget, as he did with Down with Hell, but instead decided to shoot the film on a budget of $10,000 for a theatrical release. According to Kitamaru, he raised the money to independently produce Versus by borrowing money from friends and family after producers refused to produce an action film with him, because to them, it was impossible to achieve due to lack of time and money. Haha, did not stop him. Filming was originally planned to last 3 weeks, but was extended to 7 months due to weather and financial issues.
Oh my.
Casting, the lead Tak Sakaguchi was hired for the lead after director Kitamaru saw a gag video that featured Sakaguchi. Kitamaru's main reason for hiring him was because he had a beautiful smile. However, Sakaguchi claims he met Kitamaru during a street fight that Sakaguchi was involved in. Kitamaru offered him the role in the film after asking him if he'd rather fight in the streets or fight in his films. Kitamaru later vouched as well that he did meet Sakaguchi during a street fight. This is like, all of the stories behind this are fucking just nuts. Like I said, the character credits in this are great. It's like the girl, the man, crazy Yakuza with an amulet, Yakuza with glasses, etc., which I think is just shows a lot of the care and love that was put into the character design. The film did not receive the title Versus until after the end of shooting. During production, the film was referred to as The Return, Down to Hell, with the number two, despite the fact that the film was not going to be released under that title. In fact, a friend of Kitamura's, who would end up working with the director as a second unit director for Godzilla Final Wars, suggested the title Versus to reference the struggles Kitamura suffers through while trying to launch his career. At around 12 minutes in, one of the thugs was shot dead at the beginning of the movie because director Kitamaru disliked the actor who portrayed him. At around 33 minutes in the scene where Sakaguchi's character holds a pistol in his mouth, the director originally called for him to rack the slide with his teeth. He tried this and broke a tooth.
Mm-hmm. God, no kidding.
One of the zombies was played by a dentist who fixed it for him. Like, that's this whole fucking thing. It's okay. Video game producer director Hideo Kojima of Metal Gear fame was an extra in the film. Kitamaru, as a friend, was later handpicked to direct the remake of Metal Gear Solid Twin Snakes. Versus is attributed to heavily influencing the sword fighting scenes in the game. Yeah. So it's just fun. It's just insane. Some friends got together and made this absolutely bonkers movie for pretty much no money. And, you know, I don't know. It's great to watch, but I cannot possibly tell you why it is what it is or what the plot is or why it ends the way it ends, because it's a weird ending. However, I can tell you it's available on Blu-ray via Arrow. So there you go. They have a special edition out.
So I don't even really like this film too much, but I love this director so much that you should search out an episode of Mick Garris's Postmortem where he interviews this director.
Oh man.
And that guy just starts telling stories of how, I think that, is there a school somehow involved in this?
No.
Okay. I think there was a school next to the woods they were shooting in.
Yeah.
It was abandoned. And that's where he was setting up his place for, you know, getting ready for the filming and everything, which meant that, you know, his actors were basically staying there. They were sleeping on the stairs.
Oh my God.
And stuff like this. And it's like, oh my God, this kid just believed in himself so much.
And all those people who turned up and got like,
yeah,
I mean, you know, I don't know how they managed to do these stunts and these fights without anyone getting murdered.
Yeah. Well, the fact that you're saying it said to rack the gun and then broke a tooth on that, that means they weren't using a fake gun. So, you know, this guy was just flying by the seat of his pants.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And like, obviously really inspired by a lot of really neat camera work in other films, because you just, it's constant. There's the cameras flying all over the fucking place. It's never boring, even though pretty much the same thing happens all the way through.
Well, yeah.
I think in that interview, he says something about like Evil Dead 2 just changed his world forever. And so that's all he wanted to do, was make movies like Sam Raimi.
Yep.
Yeah, it's a pretty fun one. That's well worth. I like you're talking about. Well, he wanted to do a low budget. He decided he's going to get a budget, $10,000,
like for theatrical release. Yeah. Like, where do you live that anybody would say, if I can get a $10,000 budget, I can get it in theaters?
Yeah, exactly. And eventually, will become a precious collection in the Arrow Video distribution line. So,
I like it. Good choice.
Yeah.
One thing I've noticed that we all did this episode is they're all first viewings.
Oh, cool.
Because I chose from 1982, Silent Rage.
Goddamn fighters. You call the police?
Not me, boss.
Nobody call the police. You must be a mirage. Ah!
The master fighter of our time. Even he could imagine the power of the indestructible man he is about to face. A creation of science whose only thought is to survive.
Can't you hear you?
The unstoppable terror of Silent Rage. Now, Chuck Norris must destroy him.
Dan, watch out!
In a final battle to the death and beyond. Silent Rage.
Budget of about $4.5 million. Box office of about $10.5 million. No Rotten Tomatoes critics, which I find very odd. This was theatrically released. It has reviews, yeah, but it just wasn't, I don't know, wasn't
it
collected.
Paid someone off.
The audience has it at 39%. Directed by Michael Miller, who in this year also directed the film Class Reunion. Do you remember that one? Yeah. Kind of a horror comedy. There's a slasher film at a class reunion, basically. Mm. 30 other TV credits, mostly TV movies, a couple of series here and there. Written by Joseph Fraley, who was also credited as writing the story for Good Guys Wear Black, and that is it. His entire career is a couple of Chuck Norris things. And I say that because this is starring Chuck Norris.
Oh my gosh.
He was in The Octagon, Lone Wolf McQuade, Walker, Texas Ranger, a ton of other shit.
And now a romantic movie with Bruce Lee.
Oh, right.
What?
Also starring Ron Silver from The Entity, Silkwood, Blue Steel, Time Cop. Tony Kalem, who was in several episodes of The Sopranos, but was a big crush of mine from one of my favorite movies, The Wanderers. Mm-hmm. And then Stephen Furst, 97 episodes of St. Elsewhere, 110 episodes of Babylon 5, but will always be Flounder and Animal House to me. So, Eric, you said you have seen this.
Yeah.
Okay.
When it was probably first in video stores, so right, it's been a little while.
I'm going to guess, Vanessa, this one is not on. Okay.
I have not seen this. I have not seen a lot of Chuck Norris.
Let me regale you with the beauty that is Silent Rage.
All right, I'm ready.
So this starts, we're in a small Texas man, and this guy, John, is in a house that he's sharing with another family. You can tell he's not of the family. It's like a boarding house, maybe. And he is on the phone. You can tell that he's kind of losing it. He's on the phone with his doctor, and he hangs up on the phone. He's clearly troubled. He goes outside to the woodshed. He grabs an axe. He kills everybody in the house.
Good Lord.
Oh, all right.
Introduce Sheriff Dan Stevens. Also not the best name for your protagonist.
Very boring.
But I do like the actor Dan Stevens.
Oh, sure.
So.
Yeah, absolutely. But a bad name.
And his deputy, Charlie, respond. And that's Chuck Norris and Stephen First. They go in, and Chuck has a little bit of a fight with the guy, throws him out the window, kicks the shit out of him a bit, and then cuffs him, drags him to the car. All these other police officers have shown up. So he puts the guy in the car, arrests him and everything. But this guy somehow not only breaks out of the handcuffs, but he kicks open the door. He doesn't kick open the door to the car. He kicks off the door of police car.
Damn.
And he overpowers one of the officers, grabs his shotgun, and then all of the officers just, they just blow him up, fill him with lead.
Whoa.
severely injured and near death, John is then transported to an institute where his psychiatrist that he had been on the phone with, Ron Silver, works along with two doctors who are also geneticists. And to save John, one of those doctors proposes treating him with this formula that the three of them had created that is supposed to enhance cellular strength and regeneration.
Uh-oh.
Silver objects to this because John is crazy. And he's like, let's let this guy die in peace. His whole life he's been dealing with this stuff. Death is a release for this guy. And the doctor pretends to agree. And as soon as Ron Silver leaves the room, he ejects him with this stuff.
Of course he does.
Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, in the hospital, Chuck Norris runs into this woman that he had a little fling with many years back. And she's clearly very angry about it. And then we find out she is also the younger sister of Ron Silver's character. But Chuck kind of romances her and gets her to drive him back home. And then they have this little little conversation in the car where she's like, no, I am never going to be with you again, blah, blah, blah. Cut to a post-coital scene of them in bed together. And it is a very strange scene in that they are he is kind of kissing and nuzzling her. And she turns to him and says, hey, don't get any ideas. And I mean, if I was Chuck, I'd be like, we did just fuck, right? I mean, what ideas do you think I'm getting? But
we have a past relationship. Right.
of just a couple minutes ago. Meanwhile, the two doctors now have taken Ron Silver back into the room. They show them what they have done. And he's furious, of course, because how dare you? But then they show him this interesting effect that the cellular stuff they were working on, and they like take a scalpel and they cut the guy's. Now he's basically a vegetable, right?
Mm-hmm.
They cut the guy's chest open and it just magically heals up. And they're like, look, it's everything we thought it could be. And he's very angry. The guy who was dead has been revived, and now he has all of these powers to heal almost instantaneously. Good thing he's just a vegetable, right?
I was going to say credits, we're done. Sounds good.
This could be problematic going forward.
And science was never the same again.
Right. He opens his eyes later.
Hey.
Breaks out of the hospital and decides that it is time to go and start killing people.
Impossible.
Come out of a coma.
He tracks Ron Silver down because in his coma, he was hearing Ron Silver saying, this is the guy that we need to let die and everything. So he's like, fuck this guy. So he goes to his house and kills Ron Silver pretty quickly. And Ron Silver's wife. Despite the fact that Silver has pulled a gun on him and shot him a couple of times. And then those killing shots also knocked him down a flight of stairs where his neck was broken. But he revives and kills him. So, meanwhile, Dan has invited Ron's sister, her name's Allison, on a trip. Let's just leave right now. I know I'm the sheriff, but I can leave right now if you want. And she says, okay. So she goes back to the house. You know, she's staying with her brother to pick up her gear for the trip and discovers her brother and sister-in-law's corpses in a very Halloween kind of way. They're hanging on a door and they flop out when she's doing this stuff. And I'm like, okay, there's some real horror tropes going on in this film. It's really odd though, because the majority of all the horror scenes take place in the day. So it gives it a very strange kind of non-horror feeling.
Weird.
John flees because Dan and Charlie have arrived on the scene because they've found out about Ron Silver and all of this stuff. So they take Allison to the Institute, but they are unaware that John, when he fled, also returned to the Institute. And he's there to get the other two doctors to treat his wounds, I guess, but he's healing, so I don't know exactly. When they express a couple of concerns with him, he kills him.
Sure.
So from there, it becomes kind of like a Terminator / Halloween movie.
Yeah.
And it's basically Chuck fighting the guy off first with a gun, then with Kung Fu, in a battle to the death, and all that stuff. And this movie would have been, I think, so much better if he had acted like a Terminator or a Michael Myers or a Jason Voorhees, but instead he gets up and runs and moves very quickly and everything. But if he was just like this big, lumbering, unstoppable force, I think that that would have amped the horror up a little bit. But I also don't know that that's what they wanted to do.
Is the guy, like, does he have his personality or is he just like a husk?
Just like a killing machine. He's mute basically from the time he is revived again. So he never says a word. And he's got like this kind of dead look in his eyes. But he, you know, when he gets knocked down, he jumps back up and runs and stuff like that. So it doesn't quite work.
Yeah. Up again.
Oh my God. Exactly. Chumbawamba.
So yeah, from there, you know, there's a big battle to the death.
Sure.
Or is he dead?
Is there a sequel to this movie?
Unfortunately, no.
Oh.
There is a remake of this movie.
Really?
From just a couple years ago, and I just watched the trailer. It is clearly like a fan film or something.
Oh.
It looks so cheap.
Oh no.
It's just like, oh my, why would you call this a remake? It's not called the same thing, but it is. It's called like Unstoppable or something like that.
Quiet Anger.
I got a little bit of trivia for you guys.
Sure.
The taglines, there are a number of them. The King of Martial Arts versus a bionic killing machine.
Bionic.
Bionic. Mm-hmm.
This is 1982. He's an indestructible man fused with powers beyond comprehension. An unstoppable terror who in one final showdown will push Norris to his limits and beyond.
No, Norris has no beyond limits.
Martial arts master versus superhuman killing machine. And then my favorite. Science created him. Now Chuck Norris must destroy him.
That's an extremely good tagline.
So this was the first film produced by Top Kick Productions, which was Chuck Norris's production company. This was the first time he had complete control over one of his films, and this company would then also go on to produce Lone Wolf McQuade, as well as that entire Walker Texas Ranger run. So they did pretty well.
Lone Wolf's a pretty good one.
Yeah.
Yeah, one of the best.
It was one of two 1982 movies directed by Michael Miller, first released in that year. The other picture was National Lampoon's Class Reunion. Both films feature actor Stephen Furst, had a maniac murder character, and also had about a dozen crew who worked on both films.
Oh my God, what a year. You'd feel like you're in a time loop.
There is an amazing fight scene in this, in a bar, that a biker bar that Chuck Norris has to basically take on. I don't know, must be 30 bikers who are one dead, and he just destroys them all. But in this biker bar is also this biker chick. And one of the pieces of trivia, only role for Lilette Zoe Raley, who played the biker chick who flashes her boobs to the deputy before the bar fight. Reportedly, one of the producers met her at a bar one night in Dallas during pre-production and asked her if she wanted to be in the movie. She immediately said yes. He told her she would have to flash her breasts on screen and asked her if that would be a problem. She just smiled, pulled up her shirt to expose her breasts and said, not at all.
Wow, what an audition.
Director Michael Miller said in an interview that while action star Chuck Norris had no problem with the fight scenes, he had a lot of difficulty improvising his love scene with actress Toni Kaelin because he wasn't used to doing them. Miller told him to just talk and have fun. And the scenes where they're kind of nuzzling and kissing, that does look like he is struggling mightily. But it looks like they're just talking and laughing, you know, in a couple of the scenes. And I'm like, these are, you know, this is perfectly fine, Chuck. You should not have such a thing against this. One weirdo thing. In the Silent Rage soundtrack, the song It's the Time for Love was sang by Katie Siegel. Peg Bundy from Married with Children. And was she on that
Sons of Anarchy?
Sons of Anarchy show and all that. So, yeah.
She's a great actress.
She needs to do a biography or something. She has one out there, maybe.
Yeah. Maybe. So just a couple last pieces of trivia that I didn't know, but you guys might have known. Did you know that Chuck Norris's tears cure cancer? But it's too bad that he has never cried.
what a dick.
Since 1940, the year Chuck Norris was born, roundhouse kick-related deaths have increased 13,000%. Oh my God. Did you guys know that Chuck Norris can kill two stones with one bird?
Oh my God.
And finally, the flu gets a Chuck Norris shot every year.
Oh, I'm so glad you found a way to fit those in. Because that's the beauty of Chuck Norris right there.
He is a gift that the world does not deserve.
Agreed. It's weird. So does anyone ever acknowledge that it's influenced by or tried to somehow cash in on the Halloween franchise? Because it sounds like so much of that is
I don't think they acknowledge that it's influenced by it, but it's, you know, it's 82. So it's right in the time when, you know, when was Halloween 2? Was that 82?
79.
Oh, is that late still?
Okay. Oh, wait, no, Halloween 2. I don't know.
Yeah. So they don't say anything about it, but this is one of those weird things where it is labeled as its genre is horror martial arts.
Weird. Yeah. I guess mine was too. So I can't be like, that's a strange combo. But
I had just never even heard of it. And when it popped up, I was like, oh, really? It's a horror martial arts movie? Maybe this will fit. So, because I was looking for a Hero versus the Terror, which is a truly bad film.
Wow. What a crazy pick. I will keep an eye out for it. And if it happens to show up on like TBS, I'll watch it.
It's on Tubi right now.
On Tubi. It's a modern day TBS.
Yes.
So, everything you want. Good choice, Eric. Much better than your shitty Snow choice.
That was your problem, not mine.
I enjoyed my Snow pick. Just no one else did.
Since seen that movie pop up on three lists of,
oh my God,
please release this movie on Blu-ray.
Seriously, they should, because I would love for that. I mean, it is perfect Vinegar Syndrome film, for sure.
Vanessa, I think it's your choice.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I might take us in a slightly different direction, guys. I don't think we've ever really dived into documentaries. So I was thinking that we should explore the horror documentary. And by that, I mean documentaries about horror movies, like something you might get on a behind the scenes or on a disc, or about horror directors, horror movie topics in general.
Cool. I love this idea. I think that, I am of the mind that any documentary is probably worth watching. People will be like, well, I don't want to watch this documentary because I don't like that subject. And I'm like, you know, you might like the documentary about that subject.
Yeah, for sure. I've seen some really good documentaries about baseball. And let me tell you, I am not a baseball person.
Yeah, or racing. Or video games.
Video games, yes.
Jesus. Yeah. We're all thinking of King of Kong. Aren't
exactly.
Yeah. Of course.
Dad, wipe my butt.
Have you ever seen American Movie?
No, I have not.
Might put that on your list.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
It's fantastic.
I love this idea.
Yeah.
You know what else I love, guys? Everybody who likes and shares our posts, who's participating in the value for value model. And speaking of that, we have a really cool thing we're going to end the show with.
The end of an era. I'll see if we can open this thing.
So this is a bottle of, Eric, can you tell us what this is?
Westward American Single Malt Stout Cask.
Oh, ooh, man.
Beautiful bottle.
Yeah, that is a really cool bottle. And that comes from Bob, who sent us this bottle because he wanted to he wanted us to have something that we could toast for our last show and then toast for our new show. So we'll be doing this again next week, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Oh, well, yeah.
If there's any left.
Yeah.
Larger variety of glasses probably in the new place.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, well, I thought
not just
that...
a flask and a bottle.
I thought that we could...
Oh, perfect. Thank you.
I thought we could do this and do a little cheers here.
All right.
All righty.
That is delicious.
Damn. That's strong shit.
Vanessa, that's going to put some hair on your chest.
Fuck.
Finally. Jeez.
I know. Sorry, guys.
I think you're not a guy at all.
I'm the most girly among us. Well, I like that the bottle says True Northwest on it.
Yeah, yeah.
Bob, you are a goddamn treasure, and we can't thank you enough for this.
That's right.
Thank you so much. Thank you for giving us something to cheers the end of this portion, this little chapter of our show.
Yeah, we'll be packing up the mics and everything and moving the table over as soon as we are done with this episode, is... right now. So we will see everybody next week, and we're talking genre documentaries.
Cool.
Our show is recorded somewhere high above Naval Station Everett at the nexus of all realities and is engineered and produced by Eric Margaret. Our theme music is Strange Eons Part 1 by the band Nightshade and is used with permission. Find Strange Eons Radio on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and wherever fine podcasts are found.
Dancing till the morning light. Forget about your troubles all the time. We can leave it all behind.